see you next time. Stay tuned for the Peace and Justice Report coming right up.
WSLR LP 96.5 FM in Sarasota and WBPV LP 100.1 FM in Bradenton. This is Ratia Murphy with your WSLR News headlines for Wednesday, February 18th. Nurses in this area are participating in a nationwide protest tomorrow, asking Congress to stop funding federal immigration enforcement agencies. The reason? ICE and Customs and Border Control are among the country's top public health threats, they say. They are also demanding hospital administrators keep ICE out of hospitals. Following the call of their union, National Nurses United, registered nurses at Fawcett Hospital in Port Charlotte will be protesting from 8 to 9 a.m. at the corner of Olean Boulevard and Aaron Street. The program headed by Florida's First Lady is paying particular attention to Sarasota schools. The Sarasota School District announced yesterday that Hope, Florida, granted it the Model School District designation. The designation makes Sarasota one of nine districts in Florida, and it comes with expanded access to family services Hope, Florida provides. The district now dedicates one person at each school as a liaison. The program positions itself as a conservative alternative to traditional government welfare programs. The stated intent is to guide people toward economic self-sufficiency and prosperity. If you vote in and around Venice in the next elections, make sure you know your polling place. The Sarasota Supervisor of Elections announced a merger of five precincts and the shifting of some of the polling places. 37 precincts have been affected by changes, most of them in Venice, some in Northport, and on the Barrier Islands. The restructuring has shrunk the number of precincts from 103 to 98, and polling places from 84 to 83. Supervisor Ron Turner described the measure as streamlining, prompted in part by population growth and the annexation of county land by the City of Venice. The supervisor will notify you by mail if your precinct or polling place has changed. If you don't want to wait, look for the My Precinct tool on sarasotavotes.gov. And a quick update from the state legislator. The Florida House agreed yesterday to name Palm Beach International Airport after Trump, but not without a raucous debate. The cost could exceed $5 million. Also, a bill that would strengthen the public's access to public records is one committee away from a House floor vote. Finally, the House backed away from a bill that would have blocked the governor's use of an emergency fund to pay for the ongoing immigration crackdown. This has been Ratia Murphy with your WSLR News headlines for Wednesday, February 18th.
Welcome to the Peace and Justice Report. I'm Tom Walker. Please remember the views and opinions expressed by hosts, guests, and callers on WSLR programs are our own and do not necessarily reflect those of WSLR, its staff, or volunteers. Our guest today is Nathan J. Robinson. Nathan is the editor-in-chief of his magazine, Current Affairs. The website is currentaffairs.org. Nathan attended Pineview School here in Sarasota, but now lives in New Orleans. He has a BA and MA and MA in politics from Brandeis and a JD from Yale Law School and a PhD in sociology and social policy from Harvard University. His published books include Why You Should Be a Socialist, Trump, Anatomy of a Monstrosity, Responding to the Right, Brief Replies to 25 Conservative Arguments, and finally, with Noam Chomsky, The Myth of American Idealism. He's a former columnist for The Guardian and has written for The Washington Post, Newsweek, New York Times, The Nation, The New Republic, Al Jazeera, and Boston Review. Nathan Robinson will be the featured speaker at our annual WSLR Fogartyville Rooted in Community celebration on February 28th. So, and you can still buy tickets And I hope anyone listening who hasn't got tickets will buy them and attend. So welcome, Nathan.
Hey, Tom. Nice to be with you.
Thank you for joining us. You live in New Orleans now, and we're recording this on Monday, February 16th. So tomorrow is Mardi Gras. Right?
Mardi Gras Day. And today is Lundi Gras.
And what happens? What's the difference?
Well, so basically, Mardi Gras in New Orleans, a lot of people think it's just Fat Tuesday. It's a big one-day celebration. But right. In fact, it's a whole season. So it starts January 6th. And what happens is it kind of builds up over the course of a month and a bit. So there's all these parades and parties, and then there's more parades and parties. And it kind of escalates to the point where, you know, today there's the parades all day, and then tomorrow is the real big party. So it sort of all builds up to that one explosion of parades and partying on Mardi Gras Day. And then on Wednesday, everything goes quiet again for a year.
Well, you went to school at Pine View in Sarasota, right?
I did indeed. So you are my hometown radio station.
Oh, great. But what took you to – what route took you to New Orleans?
Well, I I'm going to have to be careful here because I love Sarasota, okay? I didn't love Sarasota as much when I was a teenager. Now that I'm older, I appreciate and love Sarasota. But when I was a teenager, I wanted to, you know, I wanted to leave. I wanted to go see the rest of America. A lot of the colleges were in the Northeast, so I wanted to get out of Florida. So I love Pine View. Pine View is awesome. I went there from... I went to Brentwood Elementary, and then I went to Pine View from third grade to through high school, and went off to, and then I went off to Brandeis. Brandeis was recommended by the Pine View guidance counselor, who said it was as close to Pine View, which is a bunch of sort of quirky, smart, you know, nerdy people with interesting interests, you know, that Brandeis was as close to that as you could get among colleges. So it was a nice fit.
And then New Orleans? Why New Orleans?
Why New Orleans? Well, why not? Why could you? once you've seen New Orleans, you'll know why New Orleans. I've been here.
It's exciting.
Yeah, I worked here for a summer when I was at the I was at the New Orleans Public Defender for a summer in law school doing an internship. And I decided that summer I didn't want to be a public defender, but I did want to live in New Orleans because, you know, the food, the culture, the music, the people are so friendly. The architecture is so beautiful. I mean, it's just a very, culturally rich city. I got tired eventually of living in the frozen Northeast for the winter and digging my car out of the snow. And in 2017, I decided it was time to move back south where it was nice and warm.
Okay, so tell us, more importantly, how and why you started Current Affairs, your website, magazine, podcast.
Well, you know, I had been, you mentioned there in your very kind introduction, some of the places that I'd written for as a freelance writer. So I'd been doing, while I was in grad school, a lot of freelance writing. And I was in a PhD program, and there were kind of two kinds of writing that I was doing. There was the academic writing, which is the sort of research papers you produce as a PhD student, and you know, if you try and get those published in academic journals. And then I was publishing sort of short opinion type pieces for various different publications. And those types of writing were both a little unsatisfying for different reasons. So the academic writing was unsatisfying because it was too technical, and when you publish in journals, only about 8 people read it. The opinion writing was unsatisfying for a different reason, because if the other writing was too technical and detailed, the opinion writing was kind of too simplistic. When I wrote for the New Republic, they had just had a new owner take it over. And the new owner said, I get bored by anything over 500 words. And I hated that. Because my stuff tends to be 5,000 words. So I wanted to do a kind of in-between writing that was deep and very well researched, but was accessible to ordinary people that you could read without necessarily having a college education. You know, it would challenge you, but it wouldn't kind of talk down to you. And so I had this idea for what the kind of writing I wanted to produce, but there was nowhere to put it. So mm-hmm. I started a blog and I started doing things on the blog. But there was at the time, there were two wonderful newsstands in Harvard Square that I would walk past every day, and they were filled with magazines from all around the world. And so mm-hmm. I'd always pick up magazines and look at print magazines, and I came to really fall in love with print media. And so I thought, well, you know, I don't see why I can't just start a print magazine. I mean, other people have done that. There's hundreds of magazines here. Why can't there be another one?
Sure. And so you did. You have a website and you have a printed magazine. I love the variety and the quality of your articles. Some of them, a lot of them you write, a lot of them you don't. And so I guess you decide what to publish and how often.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
Yeah, so, I mean, it's wonderful because you get a lot of freedom when you're the editor-in-chief. You have, you know, you can find all the people whose writing you like. And so when I started putting the magazine together, one of the first things I did was recruit all the people who were my favorite writers and put them in print. And you realize you have this enormous freedom to sort of curate interesting pieces on all kinds of different topics. And, you know, despite our name, and the name is kind of funny because I realized that, to my shock, there was no other publication called Current Affairs. And I thought, surely that must have been taken. But it wasn't taken. So I thought, well, that's fantastic. Let's go with that. But despite the name, we kind of joke internally that we're oftentimes historical affairs because we write about things, you know, we'll run articles about things that happened 100 years ago or 50 years ago. I just wrote about, I had pieces in recent issues on, you know, Franklin Roosevelt. My piece for the new issue is on, the time when Bernie Sanders was mayor of Burlington, Vermont in the 1980s. So we cover this huge, broad range of topics. And despite the name, it's not actually all particularly current. We actually try and get away from the news cycle and just cover things that interest us.
I love that about what you do. I think everybody should explore that website as soon as they finish listening to this program.
Yeah.
You have podcasts as well. You have the Current Affairs Radio Hour and so forth. Yeah. How many contributors do you have on the average, or does it vary?
Well, you know, that's a funny question because I actually don't I don't know. I have never counted because we've been going 10 years now. We're just working on our 58th print issue. Uh-huh. And we've also had thousands of online articles over that time. Yeah. And those articles, as you said, I've written a lot of them myself. Other members of our full-time staff have written a lot of articles. But then we have this massive web of contributors around the country and around the world. So hundreds of people have contributed to Current Affairs at one time or another in the course of our publishing this magazine. And if people listening are writers, we actually take pitches all the time. We're always looking for new material. And we kind of distinguish ourselves from other magazines in that we don't care if you've never written for a magazine before.
Wow.
We don't care if your writing's a little unpolished. We'll help you. We care about the subject matter. So if you go to currentaffairs.org, in the drop-down menu, there's a thing that says pitch us. And you can write what you're interested in writing about. Let us know. And we're always looking for new material.
That's great. How many writers would you say you have at any one time, or a total hundreds, or?
Well, no, not. I mean, it depends what you mean by at any one time, right? So we publish 5 articles a week on our website.
Wow.
One of those is from our print issue. One of those is usually an interview. And then 3 of those are online exclusives. And of the online exclusives, usually 2 will be by contributing writers and 1 will be by one of our full-time staff members. So each week we're bringing in 2 outside writers to do things on the website. Usually each print issue has 10 articles in it. Usually 3 of them are by our staff. 1 of them's an interview. And then the remaining 6 are by outside contributors.
Wow. Okay. Very thorough. And it's been going 10 years, right?
Yeah. 10 years. We just had our anniversary party, August. of last year, and we had all sorts of wonderful subscribers come from all around the country to here to New Orleans to celebrate our 10-year anniversary with us. And it was great because, you know, when you're making the magazine, you often don't really know who you're writing for. You write the pieces of writing, you send them out into the world, you know, you mail off all the magazines, but you don't know who's picking it up, who's reading it. So that kind of subscriber event is amazing because we actually find out, you know, we meet the people who've actually been reading it.
Oh, you invited subscribers. I didn't catch that. I thought you invited the authors. Subscribers.
Both. Wow. Yeah. We had our writers there, and we also had readers of the magazine.
Great. I'll come next time.
Yeah. Well, you are a subscriber now, so if we can actually get you your magazine.
Okay. Importantly, you are the main speaker here in Sarasota for the WSLR Fogartyville Rooted in Community Celebration, February 10th, 28th. So you're flying in.
Yeah.
And your topic, and this is all my broadcast here, is to make people want to buy more tickets to come see you in person.
Yes.
Yes, your topic will be the importance of independent media.
Yeah.
And it's essential, as you said in the past, for democracy. It should not be dependent on advertisers, investors. Tell us more about that and your upcoming talk.
Yeah, I'm so excited, and it's a real honor to get to come and speak at the WSLR fundraiser, because obviously I'm from Sarasota, and I'm someone who's gone out into the world and kind of built a career in independent media, and, you know, I feel a real kinship with WSLR because, you know, we are like y'all. We are a nonprofit. We, you know, don't have any corporate backers, and so I understand really well the struggles of, you know, of a small media organization with a staff of, you know, a full-time staff of under 10 people, and how, you know, you've constantly got to be, you know, appealing to your listeners in your case, or your readers in our case, for their support, because, you know, you end up saying it over and over, you know, without your support, we can't keep doing this. But it's literally true, right? You have to have this base of devoted people who care about what you do. And so I want to use this speech as an opportunity to go and make the case to people who come for, you know, not just say, you know, we can't do it without you, you know, please will you continue to support us, but also to discuss a little bit why institutions like these matter for communities and why they matter more and more as we're seeing a lot of the mainstream news kind of be taken over by billionaires, taken over by people who don't necessarily have the interests of the public at heart. I'm thinking of the recent Washington Post debacle. And, you know, so it's more crucial than ever when you have these little institutions. Often so many local papers have gone out of business or have consolidated. And so, you know, if you want real, authentic news and journalism that's done in the public interest, you know, you have to support institutions like WSLR.
All right. Thank you. And I have heard that there may be some future projects that you're working on with WSLR.
Indeed.
Give me a hint.
Well, so, you know, it's no secret. We've had a podcast for, about 8 years now, and we've just been doing it as a podcast. But, you know, a lot of people do still listen to the radio. In fact, way more people listen to the radio than listen to podcasts. People kind of assume it's the other way around. But I think it's about a third of Americans listen to podcasts every week, and about 80% of Americans listen to the radio at some point or another during the week. So radio, you know, is not a dinosaur. Radio is still very much the way that people get a lot of their information. And so one of the things we've been hoping to do for a long time is to adapt our current affairs podcast as a radio program. And so we are in talks with WSLR because we've been looking for a host station, you know, someone to be our home base for this. And we're really hoping that we can figure something out with WSLR to where they'll be our home base station, which would be very, it was great for me because it's like a, you know, a homecoming for someone who's a Sarasota boy. But you know, so we've been trying to put together a really cool radio show. And if it all works out, we will hopefully be debuting this year this radio program and then licensing it to stations all around the country.
Beautiful. We're already a Pacifica affiliate, as you know, mm-hmm. and that would help. If you need a slot, you can have mine. I'm 83. I would be
We don't need your spot. Peace and Justice Report is important. Come on. We'll fight. We'll squeeze in elsewhere. You got to keep doing this, man.
Okay. Well, we'll be glad to have you. It's quality stuff. And I want everybody to go to currentaffairs.org and check it out. By the way, I don't see any restriction for reading when you could join, you could pay money, but I don't believe you require it just to read your article. Is that true?
That's right. In fact, we're very proud of that. I'm glad you drew attention to that, Tom, because it's something we've distinguished ourselves from other magazines by, not having a paywall. So I really worry about, I wrote an article a few years ago called "The Truth is Paywalled, but the Lies are Free." And it's about how, you know, when good journalism, when really good stuff is behind a paywall, only people who are really committed and who can afford to pay money get to read the stuff. Right. And I think that ultimately creates a big problem for a democracy where you need everyone to be informed. You need everyone to have access to high quality information. And so we committed from the start. We made a few commitments. One of our commitments was to no advertising. Wonderful. One of our commitments was to no paywalls. And as a result, everything is available online for free. I mean, people subscribe to get the print edition of the magazine. Sure. But we actually put digital PDFs of all of the magazine archives up through the end of the previous year. We put that all online for free. So wow. You can read all of our archives. You can go on and read. And basically, we ask that if people like it, they consider supporting us to the extent that they can. And so that's... You know, it makes it a lot harder because it means that you're constantly pleading for donations and, you know, everyone can read it for free. So a lot of people don't pay money. But we think it ultimately is really important that publications, you know, if you care about what you produce, if you care about the writing that you're producing, I've never actually run the numbers, so I don't know what they are, but I'm guessing that the difference between a paywalled article and an article that is free to the public, in terms of the audience that it reaches, I'm sure a paywalled article reaches, I don't know, a tenth of the audience that a free article reads, because it only reaches those people who are willing to pay for it. And I just think that's a very bad situation when everything is locked behind these gates and people, you know, first off, I can't afford to subscribe to, you know, 20 different sites in order to read all the things I want to read. So we do make so much of what we do available for free.
Yes, I get a lot of my news from New York Times, which costs a little bit of money. It's well mm-hmm. worth it in my opinion, and I wouldn't know what to do without it. But but you're right about the paywalls. And so you make your money basically from contributions and the people who buy into the printed issue, right?
Yeah. Yeah, it's a few donations. We've gotten a few grants recently from charitable foundations. But the main source of our revenue, the thing that pays all of our writers, editors, the artists, the printing, the web hosting, the rent, you know, is mainly from print subscribers. And we're really proud of the print edition. The print edition is kind of our pride and joy.
And you mentioned worker-owned models, too. I don't know how many do you have some of your workers own part of the
– Well, we're a nonprofit, so we're a 501c3 organization. Gotcha. So it's not really owned by anyone. It's operated by its board of directors, and then it's – so everything – all of the money that we make – no one can own it or sell any piece of it. All of the money that we make goes directly back into just making more material.
I love it. It's just like WSLR.
Yeah, it's just like WSLR.
Here's a quote I read. I don't know whether it was from you or from someone, maybe one of the links you sent me. It says, by now we know what happens when a community loses its newspaper. People tend to participate less often in municipal elections, and those elections are less competitive. Corruption goes unchecked, and costs sometimes go up in town governments. Disinformation becomes the norm as people start to get their facts mainly from social media.
Yeah.
I assume you agree that's all true.
Yeah.
What shall we do about social media and the untruths that people can discover there? Is there any way to counteract that?
Well, we are working on counteracting it. I mean, you're working on it at WSLR, and we're working on it on Current Affairs.
Right.
In Current Affairs, I think that, you know, we've really hinted at what the solution to this problem is, which is that you need to build independent, nonprofit, community-oriented, public interest journalism outlets. They need to be totally free of corporate backing, because if they are for profit, if they're bought up by a corporation and the corporation realizes that it's more profitable to lay off half the journalists and pivot to something else, they'll do it. I mean, that's what we just saw at the Washington Post, is they've laid off a third of their staff. They've shut the book review section. You know, they closed their Middle East bureau. I mean, these are journalists doing important work, but because it was considered to be costly work, they were not considered cost effective, and so they're gone. And so that kind of governance model, even if you have a really good billionaire who owns you for a while, it's just very risky because you're relying on that person and you're giving that sole person so much control, and you're depending on them to operate it in the public interest. Whereas an organization like WSLR, like Current Affairs, operates in the interest of its readers and in your case, your listeners, and they are who we are here to serve.
We have, in Sarasota, it used to be privately owned by a family here, and it was sold through several owners and ended up with USA Today. But we have a small nonprofit, Suncoast Searchlight, which has just started up to help out with the news, local news. So we're trying. And the paper, as you know, got much thinner and less interesting as news from 2 days ago and so forth. What about some people talk about NPR? Now, here's another quote I read. Again, I don't know whether it was your stuff. It says, quote, NPR has become a partisan news service with a sterile professional tone that belies an underlying allegiance to a very narrow range of political viewpoints that are largely inoffensive to those in power. I've often thought that. I've never said it so well. Yeah. Do you agree? Or
I would agree with that. I don't think I wrote that. I think that was from an article in Current Affairs. I don't listen to enough NPR to have the informed opinion that the writer of that article had. But I mean that goes to, I mean, the discussion there is about the importance of, you know, a real broad range of voices. One of the reasons you're a Pacifica station rather than an NPR station, one of the wonderful things about the Pacifica stations in this country is that they really do let on a broad range of voices. They're often more community oriented, often people who are, you know, who are not career professionals in radio, who don't sound like everyone, you know, there's a distinctive NPR voice, right? And everyone's got that voice.
I know.
But they're quirkier, and they represent, you know, the broad cross section of Americans. They're not limited to people who you know, have gone to fancy schools and who have you know, a particular narrow worldview. And I think it's so important to have those community radio stations that really, really make an effort to represent and showcase the voices of the people in the place. One of the problems with the NPR stations is that they all broadcast the same national NPR shows. It's the same. You go around and the NPR station in Seattle and the NPR station, you know, in Los Angeles and the NPR station in, they're all broadcasting the same 10 shows.
And
you know,
most of the minutes in that hour.
And so, you know, I like some of those shows. I love Wait, Don't Tell Me. You know, I like some NPR stuff. But But, you know, I love the way that a community station like WSLR is putting together totally original programming. Right. It's really, really hard. I know it because we've, you know, had to produce original stuff with a very small staff and a very small budget. But I think ultimately what's so great about what y'all do is that you are creating genuinely Sarasota radio. It is about Sarasota. Yeah. It is made by the people of Sarasota for the people of Sarasota.
Exactly, exactly. Let's see. Well, we've got quite a few more minutes here, 30 more minutes. Let's, what's another favorite topic you'd like to talk about? I have BuzzFeed News here. I have Rupert Murdoch.
Oh, Rupert Murdoch. Well, I mean, Rupert Murdoch's just another example here of what happens when you have, you know, billionaires controlling media. I did a whole article called How Rupert Murdoch Destroyed the News. And there's someone who has, you know, almost no commitment to the public interest, right? Who first went from Australia to Britain, where he found, where he ran some of the most infamously trashy tabloids in the world, right? And where basically, in order to make money, he would foment hatred, right? So these tabloids, these trashy British tabloids, would put up people on the front page and basically get you to hate and boo them and jeer them. I mean, they really appeal to our worst instincts.
Yes,
and that's what happened. And then when he came to the United States and started Fox News, I mean, we have seen over the course of the last 30, I think we're around the 30th anniversary of Fox News existing. I think they were founded in the mid-90s. And over the course of that 30 years, we've really seen, you know, what a network like that, that has that same kind of commitment to making people fear each other, to making Americans afraid, to making them paranoid, to making them angry. I mean, we've really seen what that can do. I mean, I think there is a deep responsibility that Fox News has for the current political moment. I think that there are all these very interesting accounts, I mean, disturbing accounts of people whose relatives, their moms and dads, their aunts and uncles, you know, especially older people who've retired, they have Fox News on all day. And they point out that their relatives have gone from very loving, warm people to being people who are angry, suspicious, paranoid. And, you know, they attribute it directly to the influence of this truly poisonous media network. And, I mean, I think that Rupert Murdoch doesn't care because he's gotten very rich off of it. But that is a really extreme example of the opposite end of what we're trying to do at organizations like yours and organizations like mine.
You know, there was a filmmaker I had on my program a year or so ago or two. Her name was Jen Senko, and she made a film called The Brainwashing of My Dad. And he got, and you might enjoy it. It's not long. It's a great film. Basically, her dad got angrier and angrier. He was listening to Rush Limbaugh on the radio. He's watching TV, Fox on TV, and he got angrier and angrier. And then he had an illness, which caused him to be semi-helpless and propped up in bed. And they changed the channel on him. And he gradually changed back to a more normal human being because of what he watched. It was great.
I mean, we all like to think of ourselves as not susceptible to brainwashing and propaganda. You know, our opinions, we like to think are our own opinions. They're not opinions that we just have because they're something that we saw on television. But I think we know empirically, I think we know from research that when Fox News is introduced into a town, the people in the town tend to become more right wing as a result. We know there's a very interesting study that I cite a lot that is about the effect of just reading an op-ed, just reading an opinion makes you more likely to agree with it. You don't necessarily agree with it, but if you give 500 people one op-ed to read, and you poll them at the beginning before the op-ed and you poll them afterwards, they will generally have shifted in the direction of the op-ed. Now, I'm not sure if that is a lasting effect, but I think all of us are kind of under an illusion when we think that our opinions are totally created by us, right? And so the information sources that we take in, they really do matter. And so we have to curate them. We have to be really careful about what we take in because, you know the phrase garbage in, garbage out. Well, if you take in, garbage information, your opinions are going to be garbage.
And so I worry about what people consume. And in fact, people are not so much reading anymore. They're watching TikToks and things like that. What is that all about? Why are people not reading anymore?
Oh, it's very disturbing to me as someone who runs a print magazine. We've actually had to do a lot more video material in recent years because that's the way to reach people now. We actually had to build here in our offices a little studio where we do videos. And so I do TikTok videos and YouTube videos. I've noticed that people's attention to long articles, it's harder and harder to get a long article to be read. It used to be when we, in the early days of Current Affairs 10 years ago, we were publishing things that were about 9 or 10,000 words. We still often do. Well, I mean, we still do from time to time, but less so because a lot of our, a lot of the time, it's just harder and harder to get people to read a very long piece of writing. I think that's a very obvious effect of the kind of, the rapidity, of social media, right? Where you see a thing, you read it, it's a meme, you swipe it, you're on the next thing. I mean, TikTok in particular, I don't know if you've ever opened TikTok, but I find it's just a barrage of videos. It's one video, then it's another video, and then it's another video. People watch those videos for 5 or 10 seconds, and you can really feel, if you engage with it for a sustained period of time, you can feel the effect that it is having on your ability to concentrate, to focus.
Yes, there's a book called The Shallows, I think, which I started reading and did not finish because I find myself...
You're on TikTok too much, Tom.
When I subscribe to New York Review of Books, I can't read those long articles. Mm. So I see it happening to me, and I suppose it's happening to everybody. Let's see.
It's true. I mean, I don't want to overstate that because we do have lots of readers who engage... with long-form pieces and who really like our magazine because we publish long-form pieces. Yeah. But it is an ongoing fight, and I do worry about there are a few ways in which the rise of social media has both negatively and positively affected what we do. On the negative side, I do think that, Twitter as a medium is just not conducive to intelligent, long-form, rational discussion. And I don't think anyone who spent time on that platform could argue otherwise. On the other hand, our magazine really wouldn't have succeeded if it weren't for social media. Because if you wanted to found a magazine in 1992, you needed hundreds of thousands or millions of dollars because no one could find out about it. You needed to launch a nationwide advertising campaign. You needed to get mailing lists and send people, sample issues through the mail. Well, what we found when we founded Current Affairs in 2016, our article started spreading through Facebook and through Twitter. And so as much as I complain about those social media platforms, they are, when they work well, a way of people discovering independent publications like ours.
Sure. Let's see. You have an article. We're talking, by the way, to Nathan Robinson. I want to remind my listeners, Nathan, it will be here February 28th in person to talk at our Rooted in Community celebration. Nathan Robinson, and his website is currentaffairs.org. I have another article, How Big Tech Killed Online Debate.
Yeah.
We live in a post-argument era. Talk about that a little bit.
Well, it's interesting you bring that up because that's very much related to what we've just been discussing about the death of long-form writing. people might remember if they were on the internet 20 years ago, if they, you know, I lived through the birth of the internet. The internet was just coming into popular use as I was becoming an adolescent. And I remember, you know, the kind of lengthy discussions that people would have on blogs and forums about politics. And one of the extraordinary things looking back at that time is that people would have these deep arguments where, you know, they were very unproductive in many ways, but they would be arguing. They would be going going through, you know, the last post that the other person had written line by line and dissecting it and refuting it. And, you know, it seemed very frivolous and like a big waste of time, and we used to make jokes about it. But, you know, you don't miss that stuff until it goes away, because now in the age of and in fact, when we were first founded in 2016 on Facebook, there used to be tons of very lengthy political discussions. We used to have a forum on Facebook where people would have, you know, the longest arguments about things. And it's all disappeared. They've stopped arguing. And, you know, there are still arguments. I mean, it's still, there's still a lot of sniping back and forth on Twitter or what have you. But I do feel like something has disappeared in these, you know, Facebook made a deliberate decision a few years ago to try and discourage people from following political stuff because it was seen as divisive. It was seen as a place where, you know, fake news flourished. And so Mark Zuckerberg said, we're really going to try and disincentivize politics. Well, you know, the result of that is that political forums kind of really dried up and died. And that concerns me because, and there's another part of it, which is that as Americans have become very more and more polarized, they feel like there's less point talking to each other. So, you know, the moment that a lefty person like me figures out that someone's a Trump supporter, right, that's the end of the discussion. We don't talk about it. We don't try and work it through. You know, people really feel like talking to the other side is hopeless. I really worry about that tendency. I really worry about the drying up of having, you know, even when arguments are passionate and even when they leave people very frustrated and annoyed at the end and they don't feel like they've worked anything out. I mean, we've got to try and have discussions with one another.
I'm glad you mentioned that, because I have a lunch 2 days from now with the a confirmed Trump fan. He can do nothing wrong, neither can I. And the president of a local veterans group, Florida Veterans for Common Sense, which is a very left-wing group.
Thomas.
And we're going to take him to lunch and see if we can figure out.
Yeah.
He lives in my building. So that's our one little outreach for this week.
Yeah.
I took him to our big banquet as well.
Good luck.
Go ahead.
I said good luck, Tom.
I'll let you know how it goes. Well, let's talk about, we've got 15 more minutes.
Yeah.
Maybe something fun. We're talking.
Sure.
We can talk about religion. I'm an atheist, as you are. And you had an article, Why We Still Need Atheism, and it mentioned Putin and so forth. I think religion is good if people would actually pay attention to what's written in the New Testament first. But a lot of the fringe groups support Trump, and religion confuses me. What do you think?
You know, I recently interviewed for the program the author of a wonderful new book called Separation of Church and Hate, called John Fugelsang. And he has, you know, one of the arguments he makes, and he grew up with Christian parents and is not, I don't even think he considers himself an atheist, but he argues that one of the serious problems with contemporary Christianity is it has almost nothing to do with Jesus. He said, you know, for him growing up, the teachings of Jesus on how to treat other people were the core of Christianity.
Right.
Right. You know, non-resistance, you know, loving your neighbor, being willing to give them the shirt off your back. You know, Jesus called people to do things that are very, very difficult, right? To act in a Christ-like manner calls upon us to do things that are, sacrifices that most of us just don't feel like we can make. I mean, who can live up to Jesus, right? Nobody can live up to Jesus.
Right.
But that's the model. We aspire to the model of Jesus. But that has nothing to do with the faith of many so-called Christians today in public life, for whom it's about naming enemies. And, you know, and we wouldn't see nearly so much hatred directed against, you know, immigrants and trans people if contemporary Christianity, you know, if all of the churches took seriously their responsibility to encourage people to live and act in a way that honors the teachings and life of Jesus. I think that's John's point in this excellent book, and that's certainly how I feel. I mean, I don't feel that the theological claims of religion about the existence of God, certainly about his loving mercy towards all of us, about the afterlife, the resurrection, I don't feel those things are true in a scientific sense. I have never believed them, and I don't think I could get myself to believe them. But that's a separate issue. Even if you don't believe them, you can say that I perfectly well respect people who do, so long as they take seriously their obligation to be a moral person. Yes. And so that's where I come down on religion. I honor the religious-inspired work of someone like Dr. Martin Luther King, you know, for whom the freedom struggle was deeply inspired by and motivated by his Christian beliefs. I have immense respect for a lot of Christian pacifists and socialists throughout history, whose beliefs have really been central to their work. And so, you know, for me, it comes down to, I believe atheism is correct, but I'm not going to be arrogant about it. What I am going to say is that if we are going to have a society that is devoutly religious, I would at least hope that we would get the moral teachings of someone like Jesus out of that.
And I think provided some insight, a quote from Putin. I can't remember it exactly. Something about, they go to heaven, it's okay.
Oh, yes, that quote. Right. So I remember now that quote. This article was a couple of years ago. The point that I was making there was that religious beliefs, I've said that, okay, we atheists can live alongside religious people. However, I think it's important that some religious beliefs are quite dangerous to us here on Earth. And Putin's quote was about something like, you know, well, even if there was a nuclear war, you know, we would just the Russian people would go to heaven. So it doesn't matter. And if you believe something like that, if you have a religious belief that in the afterlife you're going to have everlasting bliss, it diminishes your motivation for making life good here on Earth for people, because it doesn't really matter. It doesn't really matter if we work out our conflicts, if we have, to cite the title of the program, Peace and Justice, right? It doesn't really matter if we have those things, because the afterlife dwarfs it. The afterlife is going to be bliss. That's already sorted. And so as long as that we know we're going to be saved, we can act recklessly here on Earth. And that's where I think religious belief becomes very, very dangerous.
Yes, and yes, I gotta agree. There's a funny Mark Twain short story about Captain So-and-so's visit to heaven. He travels for so long to find heaven, and it turns out it's populated by all sorts of aliens and other people, and it's a very humorous book, short story. All right, so we're still talking to Nathan J. Robinson, the publisher of Current Affairs magazine at currentaffairs.org. He'll be in Sarasota February 28th, speaking at Rooted in Community here at Fogartyville. So what articles or plans do you have for the future?
What articles or plans? Well, we're just finishing up our new issue of Current Affairs, which is going to go to press at the end of the month. As I mentioned, my article for that issue is about a new book called Bernie for Burlington that is about a very interesting book about 1980s Burlington and Bernie Sanders' time as mayor. There we have an article that is a review of a book called The Myth of Red Texas that is about the history of leftist political movements in Texas. You know, Texas is often talked about as a red state, but in fact, the history is very complicated and interesting. My colleague Alex is writing about the history of the Molly Maguires in the 1800s Pennsylvania, you know, and the labor conflicts between miners and mine owners and what we can learn from examining those conflicts today. We have an interview with the gender scholar Judith Butler, who is sort of widely seen as the exemplar of the woke postmodern academic left. But I had a very interesting conversation with Judith Butler about the roots of the right-wing panic about so-called gender ideology. We have another article about a 1940s socialist experiment in India. So we've got all kinds of rich material coming up in the next print edition.
I'm so proud of you. That all sounds interesting to me. You know, we have... we're also friends of the Nation magazine. I go on their cruises. John Nichols is a friend.
He comes
to Fogartyville every year on the way to the cruise and gives us an inspiring speech where, based on the current political trends. I love John, but I like the people within the Nation.
Yeah, John Nichols, excellent writer. Yeah, really, really phenomenal writer. We have a couple of his books here. Really one of the best people. I want to get him on the Current Affairs show, actually.
Oh, he'll probably, I'm sure he'll do it if he has the time. Wonderful guy. I've met his mother, you know, just really nice people.
I met him in 2018 because we were following the Michigan gubernatorial campaign, and we were in a little reporter's bus traveling around the state of Michigan following Abdul El-Sayed as he campaigned for governor.
Okay, so, you know, one thing you might put in your Current Affairs magazine is upcoming events. Conferences, speeches, book reviews, things people could look forward to, seek out, they wouldn't have known about otherwise.
Because that's a good idea.
You have such a wide reach and knowledge. That's your national perspective or international perspective. You know, I noticed I didn't see a lot of international articles. Of course, I just glanced, but,
We have some. We have some, but we're writing for mostly an American audience, and it's a little difficult. One of the struggles for a small publication like ours with international articles is it's very difficult for us to fact check those articles when they come in, because if we're not familiar with the politics of the particular region or country, those articles are a lot hard. They take a lot more resources to publish than American articles. But we welcome new submissions on international topics. So as I mentioned, please pitch Current Affairs. We're always looking to expand our coverage of international issues.
Okay. Amy Goodman, I don't know how she does it. She has contacts all over the world.
I know. They're amazing at Democracy Now!
She's been to Fogartyville several times, too.
Oh, cool.
Yeah, she follows, in fact, as a matter of fact, in five more minutes, she'll be on the air after me.
Nice. She came to our 10th anniversary, said some very nice things about Current Affairs. So she's very supportive of independent media.
Well, yeah, and she's written books and so forth. Have you written a book? I can't remember. Have you written a book yet?
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Oh, well, no, I've mentioned them.
You mentioned them. They were all in the intro, Tom.
My excuse is I'm 83 years old. All of those books sounded wonderful. In fact, I ordered three of them. They're on my Kindle reader now.
Yeah, yeah.
Excuse the...
No, don't worry.
This is fun. It's fun being live. It's fun talking to you. It's fun talking to somebody who knows what they're talking about. You're going to be a really great addition to the airwaves of WSLR.
And hopefully I'll give a decent speech. At the fundraising dinner.
I don't think you can help but give a decent speech. But how many minutes are they giving you? That's what I'm worried about.
I don't know. I think 15 minutes.
Yeah, that's not enough.
We'll see. You might be sick of me by 15 minutes. We'll see.
Tell Jesse you want 20.
Okay, all right.
Came all that way. They got mostly music and people eating.
It's going to be great. It's going to be a really great event.
You'll love it. And you've never seen our studios, right?
Oh, yeah, no, I did. Jesse gave me a tour. It was wonderful.
Oh, that's right. When I was on the board, like 7 years. I was the one who signed the mortgage to make that our own. Nobody could ever take it away, in other words.
Yeah, well, good thing you did. That's great because,
We were worried some board could say, let's make a little extra money.
Finding ways to resist temptations like that is important.
Yes, yes. I put in also into the bylaws that you got to retire after 5 years, but something like that.
It's also great that you own the building because, the rents around there are going up all the time. So, the fact that you will always have that station there is really important.
And we're going to build up and better and do all sorts of great things. We just got a $100,000 grant from a local, I believe we've just run out of time. But anyway, Nathan J. Robinson, wonderful to talk to you.
Great to talk to you. It's great to meet you, Tom. Great to talk to you.
Okay, I'm going to stop recording. Stay on one more minute.
Yeah.
Okay, stop.
Well, that was Nathan J. Robinson of currentaffairs.org. You're going to be able to hear him live here in person February 28th at Rooted in Community, which is our annual, it's a fundraiser, a celebration of what we do, and I hope you can come. The tickets are still available, February 28th. Good sushi, all sorts of stuff, music to it. You'll like it. We have a couple of minutes here before, 4 minutes before Amy Goodman. I want to read a couple of PSAs. If you're a nonprofit organization in the Sarasota area, you may wonder how you could get more publicity for your efforts. Well, we offer free PSAs, announcements that we intersperse all through our broadcast day. And they cost you nothing. We help you write them. They're a certain length, and why not? Why not? Let me read a couple here, since I have 3 minutes. The Safe Place and Rape Crisis Center, SPARC, is the state-certified center for domestic and sexual violence services to Sarasota and DeSoto counties. The organization offers free and confidential programs and services for survivors and their children, including a 24-hour helpline, an emergency shelter where the address is hidden, counseling, legal advocacy, and more. And their 24-hour helpline is 941-365-1976. They also have a place where they sell donated items, thrift shop. It's called, It's in downtown Sarasota, treasure chest, something like that. Anyway, SPARC is great. Another ongoing announcement we have is the Sunshine Community Compost. It has a community composting service, designed to divert food scraps from landfills and provide participants with nutrient-rich soil for gardening. For more information, go online to sunshinescommunitycompost.org. We have Suncoast Blood Centers here who depend on local blood donors. They're a local nonprofit, and they provide safe, high-quality blood products to hospitals and patients across Southwest Florida since 1949. So for more information about donating blood, just go to suncoastblood.org. I got time for a couple more. The Suncoast Area Narcotics Anonymous offers peer-led support for individuals seeking recovery from addiction. Meetings are held daily throughout Sarasota and Manatee counties with options for in-person or online participation. Immediate assistance is available through the 24-hour helpline at 941-257-5055. And more information about the meetings is available at suncoastna.org. NA standing for Narcotics Anonymous. Also, youth. I'm familiar with them, is a nonprofit charity that provides peer support services, educational programs, advocacy, and referrals for gay, lesbian, bisexual, transgender, intersex, and questioning youth from ages 13 to 24, and for their family and friends and the community, therefore enhancing their self-esteem, promoting healthy dialogue, and increasing awareness of sexual minority youth issues. For more information about services and upcoming events, go to also